1973, after the Feast of Tabernacles, I was working in Germany. Germany and five other European countries were boycotted by OPEC for having allowed the United States to rearm Israel during the Yom Kippur War. And so we had 4 weeks of carless Sundays to compensate for the lack of petroleum that was being shipped to Europe. Very interesting experience. Let's start off by asking the question, how much does gasoline cost in Europe? This is where I fill up my car. It's about a quarter mile from my home. Since I'm here, come all this way from Europe, I thought I'd give you a free German lesson, and you're going to learn today what the German word for car wash is. It's right here. Car wash. I just wanted to make sure that this was worth the price of admission. Well, the fuel that I use is the top one there. That's regular gasoline, Benzin, as they call it in German. And you see, this is taken last 2 weeks ago, that regular is selling for 124.9. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, let me fill up there. That's a liter, not a gallon. So let's do the math. There are 3.79 liters to a U.S. gallon, and the euro is currently worth about $1.30. Actually, now it's worth $1.31, but at the rate of $1.30 U.S. to 1 euro, that means that for me to fill up my car at this gas station, I'm paying $6.15 a gallon. So when President Bush mentioned last May, in May of 2006, that he was concerned that the price of gasoline in the United States had reached on average the $3 level for regular gasoline, we in Europe were thinking, bring it on. We'd really like to have that kind of price. Of course, a lot of that price is taxation, but it does go to show that energy is a very expensive commodity in Europe. Now, some of you may have seen this presentation, which I've modified since, in Indianapolis last June. So if you were there, you're not included in my next question. Does anybody know who this fellow is? Any takers? Okay, now you, if you were in Indianapolis, you've forgotten who he is. We know a lot of Europeans think that Americans are pretty ignorant when it comes to European leaders and politicians. Most Europeans could tell you any number of cabinet members in the U.S. administration, and I doubt if there's probably one or two people present who could tell us, let's say, who the foreign minister of France is, maybe one or two people who could tell us who the foreign minister of Germany is. You may know who the leaders of those countries are, but most Germans know who the American Secretary of State is, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Treasury, and they also know who the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank is. Now I'm going to tell you who this is, and once you see his name, you'll know as much as you did before. This gentleman is Andris Piebalgs, and he happens to be the European Union Commissioner for Energy. So his responsibility is to track energy consumption within the European Union. And he's not only a statistician. His responsibility also includes making projections for future consumption in Europe and trying to plot a course for the EU. So what are the current stats involving Europe and energy? These have been compiled by Mr. Piebalgs' office. For the last 10 to 15 years, energy consumption in Europe has been fairly constant, growing at about 1 to 2% each year. And in the year 2006, which just ended some 6 to 7 weeks ago, the European Union imported 76% of the petroleum that it consumed. And that percentage has been increasing for years. Every year, the percentage of oil that Europe imports grows ever larger. A lot of people think that they tend to think of the European Union in terms of individual countries, and if you view it that way, obviously the individual European countries, being smaller in population than the United States, consume a lot less oil. But if you view the European Union as a whole, then the EU as a whole consumes 15 million barrels of oil a day. So the EU is in second place behind the United States. The United States is the world's largest consumer of petroleum. The U.S. consumes about 20 to 20.5 million barrels a day. It's interesting that the EU, viewed as a whole, and the United States, if you combine them, they consume about 45% of the oil that's produced worldwide. Just an interesting statistic. And then if you view the EU as a whole, in third place after the European Union comes the People's Republic of China, which currently has a consumption about half that of the EU. So China is currently using about 7 million barrels of oil a day. Of the oil that the European Union imports, 50% of that comes from the Persian Gulf. The OPEC countries that line the Persian Gulf, and we'll see a map of that here in just a little bit. Europe is a very environmentally conscious area, and so a number of Europeans say, well, we can use natural gas as a substitute for petroleum, because presently the European Union does have more natural gas than it does petroleum. But even so, currently, the figures for 2006, the EU imported about 40% of the natural gas that it consumed. So those are the statistics that Mr. Piebalgs records every year. And as I said, he doesn't only keep track of what's happening now. He looks to the future based on trends and based on the depletion of European supplies, and he makes predictions for what things are going to be like in the future. So his office has also prepared an analysis of what the energy needs in Europe will be in the year 2030. Now that seems like a long way off, but that's only 23 years. And 23 years is not a very long time. According to Mr. Piebalgs, based on current trends, by the year 2030, the EU will be importing 90% of the oil that it uses. So from the current 76%, that dependency is going to increase to 90%. And the percentage of natural gas that the EU will be importing will increase from a current 40% to 80%. And if we ask the question, who's going to deliver the oil and gas for the European Union? Those two areas will be primarily OPEC, and when we say OPEC, we mean the Persian Gulf, and also Russia. Those are the main suppliers for the European Union. The European Union finds itself in a bit of a quandary, because even to this date, and this is one of the things that Mr. Piebalgs is working on, there is no coordinated energy policy for all of Europe. It's still the case that each EU country negotiates on its own with its suppliers on price and import quantities, rather than the EU doing this as a unit. If the EU would work as a unit, they'd have much more leverage with suppliers. And since there has been no coordinated energy policy within the European Union, the EU has tended simply to rely on traditional suppliers, formerly the Soviet Union, today Russia, and the Persian Gulf, and other areas that might have been potential suppliers have now been pretty much taken up by the People's Republic of China in long-term contracts. So there aren't a whole lot of alternative sources for Europe to turn to, because, as some European analysts themselves say, Europe's been asleep and has been allowing other areas, primarily Asia, to make long-term contracts with other potential suppliers. Now, if you look at this map here of the Middle East, you see the Persian Gulf countries, who are all OPEC members there, highlighted. And this area of the world has a majority of the claimed oil reserves, the proven oil reserves. Of all the oil reserves, for conventional means, we're not talking about shale oil. There are huge shale oil deposits in the Rocky Mountains of the United States and Canada. We're talking about just conventional oil fields. Of the total amount of reserves that are known worldwide, 58% are right here. And the interesting thing is that OPEC's share of total oil reserves, and I should mention that these aren't all the OPEC countries worldwide. OPEC as a total has about two-thirds of claimed or known oil reserves. And 58% of the total are here, so you could say basically for all practical purposes, OPEC's oil reserves are right here. There are other OPEC members like Venezuela and Libya who also have oil reserves, but by no means comparable to what's available in the Persian Gulf. And the interesting thing is that OPEC's share of total oil reserves is growing as time goes by, and people want to know why. And I'd like to ask my assistant, Garrett Fenchel, if he would come down here, please. He's got a little demonstration for you. And we need a volunteer in the audience who's going to be the whole world. And let's see, here's Mr. Eddington. He's been a big help so far, so if I could ask Mr. Eddington to stand up. Mr. Eddington's going to represent the whole world. Now, being from Australia, and I think he's in the meantime become a naturalized Yank, maybe this is something he'd like to do, be the whole world. Now, if Garrett would show the audience, he's got two types of oil barrels here. He's got an oil barrel that says OPEC, and he's got another one that's got the X through the OPEC, and these are the suppliers. And the OPEC countries hold about two-thirds of the world's reserves, and the non-OPEC countries hold about one-third of the world's oil reserves. And he's got 12 cards in that ratio, 8 and 4. Now, the interesting thing is that OPEC and non-OPEC are meeting the world's demand for oil in roughly equal amounts. So about half of the oil being supplied comes from OPEC, and about half comes from non-OPEC. So Mr. Eddington's thirsty today. Let's give him his fix. He gets one of each. So his energy needs have been met for today. He's looking more chipper all the time. And you know what? Tomorrow he's going to be thirsty again. He's going to need one each of these barrels, so Garrett will give him another one of each. Now, if Garrett recounts, he will find that his ratio is no longer 2 to 1. It's 6 to 2, 3 to 1. So since OPEC and non-OPEC are supplying the world market roughly in equal amounts, percentage-wise, that means non-OPEC's reserves are being depleted more quickly. That's logical. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Eddington. That was very kind of you to be the whole world. So why is OPEC's share of total oil reserves growing? Because non-OPEC producers are currently supplying about half of the demand, and they have less reserves to begin with, to start with. So what that means is that in the future, the amount of oil reserves that are in this region are going to increase from currently about 58% over time to well over 60%. So most of the oil that's left in the world by conventional means is found in this area. Now, since last summer's Israeli Hezbollah conflict, the price of oil on the world market has come down quite a bit. And people think, well, maybe the danger is over. One of the negative side effects is that if the oil price drops, it removes the incentive to develop alternative sources of oil, like shale oil, because shale oil is still a very energy-intensive production process, and it costs a lot of money. So for shale oil to be produced in large quantities and to be economically feasible, that only works if the price for conventional oil is very high. So right now the price of oil is about $58 a barrel, and that just means that potential alternative sources won't be pursued as readily. So the European Union has a very keen interest in supplies from the Persian Gulf. In April of 2005, when the price of oil first went above $50 a barrel and just stayed above that price and everybody was concerned about it, Mr. Piebalgs went to a meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council. Here you see him talking to the Kuwaiti oil minister, who at that time was the chairman of OPEC. And as I mentioned, The European Union in 2006 imported 50% of its oil from the Persian Gulf. Let's turn to natural gas, which some believe will be a possible alternative source of energy for Europe other than oil. 70% of proven world natural gas reserves are in two unstable regions. We've already mentioned both of them. One of them is the Persian Gulf, which holds about 41% of the world's supply of natural gas. And the other area is Russia, with about 28%. And those two areas are the main suppliers for Europe in terms of imported natural gas. In 2006, the European Union imported 40% of the natural gas it consumed. And 10% of the gas it consumed came from the Persian Gulf, was liquefied and brought to the EU in large container vessels, and 30% of Europe's consumption last year came from Russia. And as I mentioned, last year the EU imported 40% of the natural gas that it consumed. By the year 2030, Europe will be importing at least 70%, and some say, like Mr. Piebalgs, it'll be up to 80% in just 23 years. So who's going to make up the gap? Now, the last picture I showed you of an individual, nobody seemed to know who he was. And by the way, if it's any comfort to you, I've given this presentation now 5 times in German-speaking congregations, and no one there knew who Mr. Piebalgs was either. So you're in good company and vice versa. But I think all of you know who these two fellows are. Former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder on the right and Russian President Vladimir Putin. When Mr. Schröder was defeated for re-election in September 2005, it didn't take long to find out what he was going to do after his political career was over. He was offered the chairmanship of the Oversight Board of the North European Gas Pipeline. That's a Russian-German joint venture, which by the year 2010 is going to be supplying Germany directly from Russia via a gas pipeline. It's a joint venture. 51% of the shares are held by Gazprom, and 49% are held by two large German utility companies. And at the time the agreement was signed, Gazprom claimed that it would be able to supply all of Europe's needs for the entire 21st century. Here you see the route of the proposed gas pipeline. It's going to run directly from Russia to the German Baltic port city of Greifswald. That's irritated Poland and the Baltic states because they were hoping that the gas pipeline would run overland through their territories, and that would entitle them to transit fees for the gas. But Russia and Germany agreed on a gas pipeline that's going to be laid on the floor of the Baltic Sea. Right now, they're clearing out debris from World War II, unexploded canisters and all kinds of things that they found along the route. And as I said, once that gas pipeline comes online in 2010, Europe's dependency on Russia as a natural gas supplier is only going to increase even more. Here you see the European Union, and I will add for Mr. Rhodes' benefit, this is 2006. Okay, so we don't have Bulgaria and Romania on there yet. European Union in 2006. And currently, Gazprom from Russia supplies the Baltic states with 100% of their natural gas, so they have an absolute monopoly on the market in those three countries. In Poland, they have 99% market share. In Germany, it's 35%. In the Czech Republic, 82%. And in Slovakia, because, as you know, following the end of the Cold War, Czechoslovakia split up into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. In Slovakia, they have 100% market share. Now, those high market shares in the eastern part of Europe are partially due to preferential treatment dating back to the Soviet days. And for Europe as a whole, in 2006, Gazprom had a 30% market share. When the North European gas pipeline was announced in December of 2005, there was a big press conference in Hanover, Germany, and Alexei Miller from Gazprom was present. He's the head of Gazprom, handpicked by Vladimir Putin. And as you can read for yourself, he was quoted at the press conference as saying, "In this century, the 21st century, there won't be any problem meeting Europe's gas requirements. Whatever amount of gas Europe needs, that's what Gazprom will deliver." Now, Vladimir Putin is an interesting fellow. He's a former KGB chief, as I think most of you know. And for several years before he was the head of the entire KGB, he was the KGB section chief in what used to be East Germany. He speaks fluent German, and when he was invited to speak to the German parliament, the Bundestag, 3 years ago, he gave a major portion of his speech in German. So when he meets Chancellor Merkel now, or previously Chancellor Schröder, for a good portion of the conversation, they don't need a translator. They talk German. Just an interesting fact. By the year 2030, and for Mr. Rhodes' benefit, this map is still inaccurate, but there's one coming that is accurate. By the year 2030, Gazprom is predicted to have a 60% market share of natural gas in the European Union. Now, recent events over the last year or two have caused some analysts in Europe to be quite concerned. They ask the question, what happens if the political climate between the EU and Russia changes, or if for some reason the EU and Russia are unable to agree on pricing? Gazprom now delivers natural gas to the European Union at pretty much world market prices, so there's no disagreement at the present time. There are those in the EU who argue you have to look at the Soviet Union's record, even if Russia is no longer the Soviet Union. All during the Cold War, the Soviet Union met all of its contracts. It honored all of its contracts with Western Europe, even during crisis periods of the Cold War. So that's what the one side says. The other side says you have to look at the facts. And one of the facts they point to is that in 1990, when Lithuania became the first of the Soviet republics to declare its independence from Moscow, how did Moscow respond to the situation? They turned off the natural gas and stopped all supplies of oil. And I should point out that the leader of the Soviet Union at that time was a fellow who, by Western standards, was considered fairly moderate, a man named Mikhail Gorbachev. And his response to the crisis was, that's it. They don't get any more fuel. And in the last 2 years, we've had similar crises involving the Ukraine, and more recently, just at the turn of this year, with Belarus. Here you have a map showing transit pipelines through the Ukraine. This is from a year ago. And these pipelines here interest us. This map is actually not 100% accurate because there are five gas pipelines that run from the Russian production fields in western Siberia into the Ukraine. Two of those pipelines are for the Ukraine, for its needs, and three continue on into Europe, into the European Union. And when Gazprom and the Ukraine were unable to reach an agreement a year ago, the Ukraine was accused of starting to siphon off gas out of the three lines that went to Western Europe. And the Ukrainian leaders said, well, you've stopped supplying us in the two lines that are for the Ukraine, and we have to collect our transit fees for the gas that you're sending on to Western Europe. That was an agreement that was standing. And because they were siphoning gas, natural gas off, the pressure in the lines dropped to an extent where Western Europe was in danger of no longer being able to be supplied. So the European Union immediately besieged Russia and the Ukraine to reach an agreement. And more recently, if you followed the news at the turn of the year, the same thing happened with Belarus. Russia was unable to reach an agreement. This time it involved petroleum, oil, with Belarus, or White Russia, as the Germans call it. And because Belarus was accused of siphoning oil out of the main pipeline that runs through Belarus into Germany, Russia simply shut down the pipeline. Now, that pipeline, interestingly called Friendship in Russian, supplies Germany with about 20% of its daily petroleum needs. And it was completely shut down for 4 days. So there are those who say that the growing dependence of Europe on imported energy is not a healthy thing for Europe. Europe needs to do something about this. So just from looking at that, the consumption in Europe today and the projected consumption in the year 2030, we draw these conclusions. Europe's dependence, growing dependence on imported energy will increase its vulnerability, and more people are talking about that in Europe. And in the future, Europe's primary areas of interest in meeting its future energy needs will be those areas that are its current suppliers, and they are the Persian Gulf and Russia. Okay, those are the facts. And we'll go from there to the Bible and look at some specific prophecies and ask some questions, some of which are speculative, but I think they're based on reason and economic necessity. In the book of James, chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, as you read along here, this is a passage that appears to be directed primarily at individuals, but often principles, spiritual principles that apply to individuals also apply to groups of individuals or even entire peoples or nations. And the Apostle James asks the question, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? You lust and you do not have. So you want something and you're not able to obtain it. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war." So the implication from this passage, extrapolating it from individuals to groups of people or even entire nations, is that a desire to have or possess something, something that you might consider a need or a necessity for yourself or your people, that can lead to conflict. Now, history bears that out. History bears that extrapolation out. Quite a few wars have been fought for economic reasons. Some historians might even argue that the majority of wars has been fought over economic reasons, even if something else was mentioned as the cause for going to war. Some would say that one of the main reasons, for example, why the Japanese attacked the United States in 1941 was to protect its expansion in the Pacific region. Japan being an energy-hungry country, the United States with possessions in the Pacific, the Philippines, Japan not wanting to be impeded. Some say that most Germans have never read the book Mein Kampf, written by Adolf Hitler. Recent surveys show that's not true. And if you read Mein Kampf, don't try to do it. It's a long dirge, several hundred pages long. But there are very clear passages in that book where Adolf Hitler says one of the reasons why the German nation needed to expand eastward were clearly economic reasons for the German people. And as a converse, so the United States doesn't come off unscathed, Europeans sarcastically said about the United States in the early and mid-1990s that the reason why the United States did not intervene to end the ethnic cleansing in the Balkans when Yugoslavia fell apart as a nation was because there wasn't any oil there. It wasn't like Kuwait. There was no economic interest that would make the United States move and stop the violence in the Balkans. So economic reasons are a major cause for conflict. Now we're going to go to Daniel 11, where Mr. Rhodes was earlier this afternoon. And we're going to take a look at the final section of the prophecy recorded in Daniel 11, which, to my knowledge, is the longest single prophecy in the entire Bible. And as Mr. Rhodes pointed out, it deals primarily with two of the divisions of Alexander's empire after his death, the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, when I was in the seventh grade in St. Louis, Missouri, and I used to have to turn in English essays, I would often get my essay back and there would be the initials PK written on there in the column. And I said, oh, my teacher likes me. She writes my initials in the column, Paul Kiefer. Well, that wasn't what it meant. It meant presumed knowledge. And when we wrote essays in English class in the seventh grade, it was a no-no to presume knowledge on the part of your readers. You had to make sure that everything the reader needed to know was in your essay. And I'm going to commit that error today. I'm going to do a PK on you. We're going to assume that you're familiar with some of the things that have been the traditional teaching of the church for many years, one of which is the item that Mr. Rhodes was mentioning about the change in the identity of the King of the North, along about verse 32, 33, 34. In the context of this 11th chapter, we believe, and it's been our traditional understanding, that the King of the North is no longer the Seleucid kingdom of Syria and it's extending eastward from there. Instead, it's the Roman Empire, which by that time, about around the time of Christ, had occupied Syria. So we're just going to presume that we're familiar with that information. In verse 40 we read, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Now I've chosen on purpose here to use the King James Bible because the King James Bible says push. In more recent translations, the word attack is used. So you may be looking at this in your Bible in a translation like the Revised King James or some other more recent translation, and the word attack is used. The king of the south pushes at him, and what will the response of the king of the north be? As you see, he comes against the king of the south with a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. The word push here in this verse is the same word that's used in Exodus 21 in the judgments when it talks about I think it's an oxen in English that gores people. He pushes at them and he is known to cause injury, and if that's the case, then the owner has to be punished. So it's this analogy of thrusting at someone. And the response of the king of the north, since all it says about the king of the south is he pushes at him or he thrusts at him. And now I'm going to use a word on purpose, a very deliberate choice of words. He provokes the king of the north. The response of the king of the south seems to be somewhat overblown. He comes at him with a full-scale military attack. We'll talk about that a little more in just a moment. Here you see on a map, and now we're up to date with the European Union. We've got Romania and Bulgaria in the EU. This is a map of the European Union. And I mentioned earlier that it's been our traditional understanding that the king of the north, after about verse 32 or verse 33 in Daniel 11, is now the Roman Empire. And please don't misunderstand, I'm not saying the European Union is the Roman Empire. But we do believe, and we have written that in our publications, I think that's even written specifically in the booklet, The Middle East and Prophecy, that the European Union is potentially a forerunner of the final resurrection of the Roman Empire. So you see that. And then you also see on this map Egypt, which was the seat of the king of the south. And so I've identified it here simply as the country of Egypt with its modern political border. I'll just throw out the thought that if it is possible for the king of the north today, geographically, to be an area other than, say, Syria or the former territory of the king of the north, could not that same logic apply to the king of the south? I don't know the answer to that question. Once again, we'll presume some knowledge. We offer three different possible interpretations of who the king of the south might be in our booklet, The Middle East and Prophecy. So we go back to verse 40 once again. The king of the south is going to push at him. My choice of words is to provoke him. And the king of north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And as we continue on, he shall enter, and notice it's in the plural, he shall enter into the countries. So it's more than one. He shall overflow and pass over. And then in the context of the king of the north entering into the countries, we also notice in the continuation of the thought, he shall also enter into the glorious land. And we're told many countries will be overthrown. And we conclude verse 41 with this thought. These shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now there are four countries mentioned as we continue in this prophecy, specifically as being either directly under the influence or directly occupied by the king of the north. There are four countries mentioned by name or implied. One of them is the Holy Land, and we will just say that's Israel. And we'll see who the other three are in just a moment. But we're told that Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon will escape out of his hand. So apparently they will not be affected by a move of the king of the north into this area of the world. And traditionally we have understood these peoples possibly to be located here, adjacent to, or possibly even dwelling to some extent in what we would call the Holy Land, or a little north of there. So I don't think we can assign necessarily a national identity to them in terms of today's states, today's nations, but geographically we have tended traditionally to say it will be in this area of Transjordan or Jordan, perhaps north of there. Some have said perhaps even part of Turkey. If we continue on in verse 42 of Daniel 11. Now here are the other three areas that are mentioned by name. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Now other translations tell us that the meaning of this, the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps, the implication appears to be they will be subject to him. Whether or not this literally means the king of the north is going to enter these countries or occupy them, I'll just leave that open for the time being. The wording here is they shall be at his steps, which has the meaning they shall be subject to him. They'll be answering to him, to his beck and call. So we have the forerunner of the final resurrection of the king of the north in the present-day European Union. As I said, it's not the European Union is not the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, but it certainly appears to be a forerunner of it. And the Bible tells us that when the king of the north, this is my choice of words, is provoked, then his response will be, he will enter into the Holy Land, what we today would call Israel, and he's also going to make some kind of a sweep that will bring Egypt under his domination, and Libya and Ethiopia will also be affected by that. Now these countries you see on the map are in terms of their modern political boundaries. Biblical Egypt apparently extended a little farther south than today's political Egypt, so the border, if you can even call it that in those terms, the border of biblical Egypt would have been a little farther south than that. And between Egypt and Ethiopia was an area called Nubia, a kingdom that at times was also under Egyptian control. And we read on in Daniel 11, verse 43, he, the king of the north, shall have power over thee, and I've added here in parentheses, hidden treasures of gold and silver. And then you also notice, in addition to having control over the treasures of gold and silver, it's also mentioned he will also have power over all the precious things of Egypt. If you look up the word treasures in a Bible dictionary, a word that a reference source that gives you definitions, you'll see that the meaning here is something that is hidden. Something that is hidden. Now consider for a moment that Daniel is given this prophecy in the 6th century B.C., and as is the case with other prophecies given many centuries ago that deal with end-time events, the people who saw these things were at a disadvantage because perhaps they were being asked to describe or portray end-time things that didn't even exist in their day, which is what we feel about the Apostle John in the book of Revelation, quite likely describing modern weaponry in terms of imagery that it was understandable to him, like grasshoppers or locusts, perhaps attack helicopters, things that he would not have known what they are, but this is what they appeared to be to him. So we're told that the king of the north, by his entering into this region, he will gain power, he will have power over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the reason why I'd like to emphasize the word "and" in this verse is that if we understand this as two independent thoughts being connected by the conjunction "and," then it doesn't necessarily follow that the treasures of gold and silver have to be in Egypt. In other words, the king of the north will have power over the hidden treasures of gold and silver, and he's also going to have power over all the precious things of Egypt. Now, there are those who say that this is a historical fact, there were gold mines in the kingdom of Nubia. They produced a lot of gold, and so perhaps these gold mines will be revived, and that's how this is going to be fulfilled. Well, I would think that if those gold mines are capable of any large-scale production, that region today being an economically depressed one, they would have been fired up a long time ago. We do have, and it's interesting that this idiom is used in many languages today. There is a certain commodity we call gold, and it's not gold at all. It's something black and oozy and gooey, and it stinks in its raw state, and we call it black gold. Remember the Clampets, the Beverly Hillbillies, when Jed was out shooting? Now, for some of you younger folks, I guess that doesn't mean anything, but you never watched the Beverly Hillbillies. Well, Jed was out shooting one day, and up came some black gold. A resource is what is meant here. So, we go to our next image here. We see the area of Europe under domination of Rome, or final resurrection of the Roman Empire in some configuration. And that's prophesied to enter the promised land after having been provoked. It will also occupy or have dominion over Egypt, and Libya and Ethiopia will be subject to this power. And then here on this particular map, this overlay, you see also the Persian Gulf nations, where up to currently 60% of the world's oil reserves are located, and that percentage is growing. Year by year, it inches up a bit. So is it conceivable that the other thrust that is of interest to the king of the north, when he is prophesied to enter this area after having been provoked, will be to get at that hidden treasure called black gold? I just submit that to you for your thinking. What would happen if there were some circumstance, as there was in the fall of 1973, when OPEC would decide that it would boycott certain countries around the world longer term and simply would not supply them with oil anymore? You know, if you don't sell your oil, it's still yours. And it's just money in the bank, because the demand for petroleum is going to continue to grow. Most of us are not aware of that, but during the administration of U.S. President Jimmy Carter, the so-called Carter Doctrine was established regarding the Persian Gulf. And that doctrine basically said that if any power not native to the Persian Gulf were to intervene in that region and try to disrupt the flow of oil to the United States, it would be viewed by the United States as a hostile action. The Carter Doctrine. Now, if the United States government is able to see that disrupting a necessity, an economic necessity, can be viewed in terms of a hostile action, other nations could view it the same way. So if the King of the South is located in this region, what is the potential that it has to provoke the King of the North? Could it be a military provocation? In my personal opinion, that's highly unlikely, because this area of the world doesn't have the military capacity to threaten Europe. However, with Europe's growing dependency on imported energy, it does have a very great capacity under different circumstances to disrupt the European economy simply by withholding a commodity that Europe desperately needs to keep its economy running. So that's just a speculation. Once the King of the North makes this move, we read, tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. If you plot that out in the Hebrew language, if you say something is to the north and the east, that can literally mean directly north and directly east. And since in biblical Hebrew there isn't apparently the possibility to combine directions as we do in our modern languages like northeast, the use of those two directions can also mean a direction somewhere in the middle, like northeast. It's interesting that if you plot a line from the glorious holy mountain to the northeast, where do you wind up? You wind up in the Siberian energy production fields. So this might be something like a game of Risk. If you've ever played Risk, and the goal is to, by strategy, outsmart your opponents, when it finally comes down to the great push for energy, and the King of the North moves into the Middle East, his energy supplies from another of his main suppliers might be cut off. Is that a reason why he's troubled from news out of the northeast? Mr. McNeely, I think, read out of this. In Revelation 9, the sixth angel sounded. I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were released. They had been prepared for the hour and the day and the month. They were released to kill a third of the mankind. And the number of the army of this power that was beyond the Euphrates was 200 million. I heard the number of them. Now, it's interesting, when Martin Luther translated the Bible into German some 75 years before the King James Bible was produced, when he got to this verse in the Greek, he translated it thousands of thousands. Literally, it's 10,000, 10,000, 10,000, which is 200 million. Because at that time, it was inconceivable that any power could have an army of 200 million. Literally, it's 200 million. When the Second World War began, the population of Germany, which at that time also included Austria and the Sudetenland, in what is today the Czech Republic, was 100 million. And Germany had 20 million men under arms during the Second World War. So having a population, 20% of your population in the military, is definitely possible. And this is talking about a force that's going to come from east of the Euphrates, and there are several countries in that region that would have the capability of supplying a military force of that number. So in the continuation of this prophecy here, the Euphrates is dried up, and in Revelation 16, the reason for that is to prepare the way of the kings of the east, who are going to approach with this mighty army and head for the Middle East. So they will come in something like this, and the tips of the arrows you see here are roughly the course of the Euphrates River, which during the Roman Empire was the eastern border of the Roman Empire. So in concluding, when you look at Daniel 11 and you consider the world's energy situation, particularly Europe, it's obvious that energy needs will keep the Middle East a focus of attention. And I'd like to submit for our thinking, because when we think about the Holy Land and what's going to happen there in prophecy, we often associate that with religion. And religion will not be the only reason for conflict in the region. There will be very real economic needs that cause nations to do what they do. And this force of the kings of the east that's going to approach the Euphrates, in my opinion, won't be coming there because a few fanatics on the Temple Mount will have sacrificed a few animals. They're coming there because now it's we're going for the throat. We're going for the jugular. Who's going to control the remaining oil supplies for the rest of time? So the purpose of our seminar today was simply to show that there are very real reasons why the Middle East will be a focus of the world's attention, and a large part of that reason has to do with economics.